Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, we've been working, trying to get this show together for a while because it's just my favorite museum and an amazing, lengthy, well, let's just call it what it is, 170 years of harbor history at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. And to talk about mounting this show, I have with us Lydia Rao. She's manager of collections and exhibits. And I have Greg Gorga, executive director of the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. And, you know, what's so fascinating about the museum is not only do they do maritime history, they do things around maritime history. And I just love that. So some of the things we've covered in the past, you know, Richard and I have done shows with Greg about the beautiful art that he's brought into the museum. You know, some of the famous surfers, believe it or not, who are ancient now, coming to speak at the museum. History of the lenses, the Fresnel lenses, all kinds of, you know, periphery stuff, but it's not really periphery. And so let me introduce, I have Greg Gorga, like I said, who joined the Maritime Museum in 2007 as Director of Development, Executive Director since 2008. He has a BA in English from Rutgers, my mom's alma mater. And it turns out that we were chatting on the email, Greg and my mom grew up very close together. My mom's a lot older than Greg, obviously, but close together. My mom was born and raised in Tenafly, New Jersey. And Greg has more than 20 years of experience working with not-for-profit, including manager of planning and development with Community Action Committee. He's the past president of the Council of American Maritime Museums. My dear friend, Professor Ray Ashley is also, I'm sure, a friend of Greg's, Maritime Museum Director down in San Diego, was my dissertation chair. Formerly served as chair of the City of Santa Barbara Community Development and Human Service Committee, and was a member of the board of Visit Santa Barbara. So he really jumped into Santa Barbara in 2008 with both feet. Lydia Rao, manager of collections and exhibits, joined the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum in 2013. She's manager of collections and exhibits since 2019. She has a BA in the history of art and architecture from UCSB, where she worked in the architecture design collection at the museum there. She's had over a decade of experience working in collections, and she's dedicated to the long-term preservation of the museum's artifacts. Cataloging new artifacts, managing archives, creating new exhibits, making materials in the museum's collections accessible to the public is part of her job. And collections manager is brought with really interesting. I know a bunch of them because, you know, people make not cash charitable contributions, and I, you know, write the appraisals in many cases. And the collection manager wears a lot of different hats. I know that. I know, you know, you're a little bit accountant, a little bit, you know, bean counter, a little bit historian, a little bit judge, jury, deaccession chair, all of the above, Lydia. So, Greg, I'd love for you to introduce the show, 170 Years of Harbor History. And if you would focus on the first little few years and explain how you made that decision to limit it to 170 years. Love to hear that.
Sure, Elizabeth. Always great to be on your show. Thank you very much. And in fact, I did speak with Ray Ashley just yesterday. He is doing well down in San Diego. We had brought their San Salvador replica of Cabrillo ship up here for Fiesta. So we always love having one of those ships up here in Santa Barbara Harbor. So, and I got to do a shout out to Lydia. Lydia actually started at the museum, I think, as a store assistant. she was quickly promoted to the store manager, and now she's, and then quickly after that, and she did amazing things with that. And now she's been in our collections department for quite a few years, and really does all those things you mentioned, and does them extremely well. And she's just been a treasure to have with us, and she's helped put this exhibit together. So, you know, a lot of people have seen the photos, black and white photos in our hallway at the Waterfront Center building of the harbor history, and always commented on them. And so we've been putting together some traveling exhibits, and we, and Lydia decided to, and Emily, our curator, Emily Falk, to create an exhibit of 170 years of maritime history, dating back to, you know, what we have on in our collection of old photos and drawings. And so it's really wonderful. And we, if we're going to travel that exhibit, we thought, well, why not put it up in our walls inside our building first before we send it out to other places? And these traveling exhibits have been great. We have a show at the airport, Santa Barbara Airport now, that Marine Megatropolis exhibit. Elizabeth, we did Bob Evans' interview on your show here, I'm pretty sure. That's all the marine life on the oil platforms. And then, so, but I'll really let Lydia go on and talk about the exhibit itself, because she worked with Emily, and she's kind of following in Emily's footsteps to put this exhibit together and then to put it up on the walls.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. So this kind of developed organically. We actually had a show that kind of fell through, and we were scrambling to put something together. And we thought, you know, why not celebrate the harbor that the Maritime Museum is located in? And so the 170 years kind of came from, it was really just, what do we have materials from? How far back do those materials go? And so that was kind of our range there, was some of the oldest drawings of Santa Barbara were done in the 1870s. So that kind of gave us a range to work in. And from there, we kind of just tried to select photographs that showed both daily life, but also some very important occasions like the oil spill in 1969 and the large storm in 1985. And so we kind of tried to showcase, you know, huge events that people would remember, but also what daily life was like 100 years ago as the waterfront was changing and evolving.
So can you tell us how it evolved? I know the wharf changed drastically, you know, so walk us through that. I remember sitting and having lectures to become a docent at the Historical Museum. And I remember someone from the Maritime Museum coming, this was in 2008 or so, someone coming and describing the change from when you had to be carried off the boat, literally, to get to Santa Barbara. So can you describe that?
Absolutely. So back in the day, larger ships would have to anchor offshore, and you would have to be rowed ashore. And the story goes that if you did not tip the sailor who was rowing you in, as you got kind of to the breaking waves, he might decide to dump you and the cargo in for a dip. And ultimately that led to several of the townspeople forming a wharf association. And actually the first wharf wasn't Stern's Wharf, it was the Chapala Street Wharf in the 1860s that was formed. But it was only 500 feet long. So it gave those smaller boats somewhere to ferry to, and folks would have to climb up a ladder onto the pier. So it kept people and mail wet, but it didn't give the larger ships somewhere to dock. And so that's where John P. Stearns came along. He actually tried to join the Wharf Association and offered to lengthen the Chapala Street Wharf. They declined, so he ended up building his own wharf, which is the wharf we know today, Stearns Wharf. And that actually allowed ships to dock up and unload their lumber, mail, cargo, and passengers.
Did I hear you right, Lydia, when you said the Chapala Street dock kept mail and people wet?
Dry, sorry.
Oh, dry, okay.
Everyone dry, but it didn't give those larger ships a place to actually pull up and dock, and people could just disembark directly. So they would still have to row up to that wharf and then hop out from there.
And even I have an interesting connection. Stearns Wharf. So I had a client who raised a Galapagos turtle, a 400 to 500 pound animal, from its, you know, egg form to this massive turtle. And he was a, you know, what do they call the people that are interested in, is it herpetologist? Anyway, he was a collector of turtles, anything. And he had a kind of a farm out in Los Olivos. He wanted to donate the turtle to a zoo, and he wanted to take the tax deduction. He was the great-great-grandson of Stearns. He was a Stern. Yeah, and highly intelligent man. I mean, and he had, because I noticed, you know, Stearns is spelled in an interesting way. And I noticed the same spelling, and I asked him if he was any relation, and he was. So, yeah, there's ancestors still in town, around town.
And I would just add that Chapala Street Pier, it was difficult for the passengers to get off those smaller ships, as Lydia mentioned, especially the ladies, because they had to climb up a ladder and they were still wearing their dresses and not pants back then. And so it was very embarrassing for them to have to do so. And then the other thing Lydia mentioned is that the lumber was an important part of Stearns Wharf, because that's really what he was a lumberman. And before that, not only would you have to get rowed in, the lumber was just tossed off the lumber schooners because they are too big to get into the Chapala Street Pier. So we used to joke you'd pick your lumber up at Leadbetter Beach or West Beach or East Beach, depending on the currents.
Now, tell me, the Stearns had an interest in doing this, right? So what did he get out of making our pier?
He had the lumber mill. He was building a lumber mill. And so they needed a bigger pier to get the lumber schooners to go right up to it and offload that way. And I believe J.J. Hollister gave him the loan to make this happen.
Yes. Yeah. $40,000. And I think he had it done within a year.
And am I remembering right that there was a certain amount of dredging that needed to be done and didn't take the first couple of times?
So that's actually more in related to the harbor itself.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of a known issue even before the harbor was built. And we had, it was mostly members of the yacht club who were pushing for a harbor to store their yachts, of course. And for several decades, actually, there was no luck in getting federal or state funding for a harbor. And so they finally realized they would have to raise those funds on their own. But the Yacht Club members actually did several tests. They dumped bales of hay and glass bottles off of the cliffs near Hope Ranch and followed what's called the longshore drift, which is how the waves move the sand along the beach. So, you know, if you've ever gone swimming and you get in right in front of your chair and your umbrella, and then 10 minutes later, you're, you know, a couple feet down the beach and you got to get out and walk back or swim back. So that's longshore drift. So that's how the waves transport the sand. In Santa Barbara, it's moving from west to east. And so they realized that if they built a harbor, there would be lots of sand buildup. Before the harbor was even built, they knew this would be an issue.
Did they try a number of times, or did, you know, you mentioned bales of hay and glass bottles?
That was to follow the flow of the ocean. So they were learning how the sand would move and affect any potential future harbor. And originally, one of the locations selected was actually the slough that's now the Andre Clark Bird Refuge over by the zoo. And they thought that they could just build a little channel inlet into that refuge and then dredge out that area to make it deeper. And that was originally one of the first selections for a harbor. But ultimately, it didn't work out, as we know.
How interesting. I can't picture that slough would have been a place for yachts somehow.
Well, they would have widened it, deepened it, put a breakwater in front of it. It might have been a better option because of the sand buildup that we experience now, and then we have to dredge all the time here. And the other slough was the Goleta Slough, but that was too far away from town.
And we do have to dredge the harbor. How often, Greg, do we dredge?
All the time. It's an annual thing. We get funding because we are a port of refuge between LA and San Francisco, but we get funding. And the times when that contract with the dredge company is run out,
we've gotten major storms and had to close the harbor a couple of times in the last 10, 12 years because of that dredging wasn't happening.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so we're celebrating today 170 years of harbor history, new exhibit at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. I'm speaking with the executive director, Greg Goriga, and the collections manager, Lydia Rayo, and we're talking about how this exhibit came together, the choice of 170 years. Basically, what Lydia was saying is that the choice was to show photos. The earliest photos are about 170 years ago. And so it's more about the exhibit itself. So when we get back from the break, I'd really like to talk about outside of the 170 years history. For example, Lydia, I'm interested to know what the Chumash did down with the harbor and the, you know, how before 170 years, previous to the 170 years, when we get back from the break. Quick break. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. We're talking about Santa Barbara Maritime Museum's history, 170 years of harbor history. And Richard was just marveling at the fact that, you know, there's well, you guys can't see it because it's radio, but Greg's screenshot in back of him is Stearns Wharf and Chapala in 1873. And you see the Chapala Pier and you see Stearns Wharf, and when was that built? When was Stearns Wharf built?
The year before, 1872. So they just celebrated their 150th anniversary, as did the yacht club this past year.
Okay, so there were two piers, and when was the Chapala Street Pier disassembled?
Lydia, do you know? I think did it burn or get destroyed?
There was a very large storm, I believe, in 1878. So actually a ship swept out to sea and demolished the Chapala Street Wharf, and parts of that wreckage also took out Stearns Wharf. And this was actually, I believe, Santa Barbara's first recorded tornado as well. It picked up a schooner and dropped it partially onto Stearns Wharf. Her crew was able to scramble to safety, and then the ship fell back into the water and basically beat against the wharf the entire night. The next morning, there was a hole of about 100 feet. So lots of loose lumber floating around, ripping out wharf pilings. A lot of the two wharfs to the south were also damaged and never rebuilt.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So that was 1878, you said, right?
Correct.
Okay, that was a big storm. It was our first tornado recorded.
Yes.
In Santa Barbara?
Probably.
I didn't even know we had
it. Very few, right. Maybe the only tornado.
Right. So the tornado came through, picked up a schooner, held it aloft for a while. It was manned at the time, the schooner, right?
Yes.
It dropped the schooner down?
Onto Stearns Wharf. A separate.
Did the people...
Yes, and the crew was able to scramble to safety onto the wharf.
Okay, so it dropped onto the wharf and it destroyed 150 feet of Stearns Wharf?
Yes, and I believe it actually, the total came up to more than that. I believe the next morning it was probably about 1,000 feet.
Okay, and it took out two other small?
And then it took out the Chapala Street Wharf basically entirely. They were never able to rebuild. And also the Serena Wharf down in Carpinteria.
And did they rebuild the Serena Wharf?
I don't believe so.
No, but there were other wharfs that we. Now, Greg, can you dive down? I know you dive. Can you dive down and see the remnants of those old wharfs?
Yeah, I don't think I'm not sure if anything's left in there. There might be, because you see remnants of wharfs off of Summerlin. The old oil wharfs are still around. You see them even at low tide. So there might be something down there, but I have never been in that area.
May I ask your the most notable thing for you in this exhibit, Greg? What would that be? What if you had to pick your favorite about the show that's mounted now? What would that be?
Oh my gosh, there's so many great ones, but probably my favorite. There's a beautiful shot of the Waterfront Center building, the building we're in, which was a WPA Works project. And as it was going up, World War II started, so the city sold it to the Navy for $1, and it's a Navy training center. And there's a photo of a sailor. You see the back of his head and his sailor hat and the whole Waterfront Center building and what it looked like. Lydia, I'm not sure what year that photo was, but I love seeing the sailor in there with the building that was the Naval Reserve building at one time. Do you know what year that was, Lydia? The one?
I don't think we have an exact date, but it would have been right around World War II, so late 40s, right after.
But there's so many great photos. Lydia, do you have a favorite? Because you put this together.
Oh, gosh. I would say probably some of the earlier photos before the harbor was built in 1929. Just Cabrillo Boulevard. I didn't realize. I found during my research for this exhibit that we actually had a narrow gauge railroad that ran along Cabrillo and up State Street. And so we had a horse-drawn rail cars that would transport people. And so probably that photo is one of my favorites. The harbor hasn't been built yet, and it's looking from State Street down Cabrillo towards where the harbor would have been. And you've got horse-drawn carriages on the beach and this horse-drawn rail car on Cabrillo. And the palm trees have just been planted, so they're maybe only about 5 or 6 feet tall. Just incredible to see how the landscape has changed over the last century.
And City College Hill, the hill where City College is now, what that looked like before they started tearing that some of that mountain down to put in Cabrillo and Shoreline is really cool to see too.
Can I ask what the difference is between, Greg, a harbor and a wharf?
Well, you know, a harbor is protecting the boats. So technically, Stearns Wharf is actually a pier, because a pier goes out into the water. A wharf generally goes along the coastline. So Stearns Wharf is kind of misnamed. And then a harbor would be more of an enclosure that's protecting mainly boats from the waves.
Okay, so and Lydia, you were saying, the reason I asked that question, you were saying in 1929, the harbor was built.
Correct. So Stearns Wharf kind of solved the commerce issue. We were able to, you know, have mail and lumber, passengers and goods go flow in and out of Santa Barbara. But all of those ships still had to anchor offshore. And if a storm blew up, there wasn't really anywhere for them to go. They either had to go down to Los Angeles or all the way out to the Channel Islands to kind of hide on the north side of the Channel Islands. So the harbor was really essential for protecting ships during time. You know, we don't have storms often, but when they do wreak havoc. And so this was a big incentive for us to get a harbor in here. And actually, it came down to one man, Max Fleischmann of Fleischmann Yeast. And he was kind of a Renaissance man. He had a lot of interests, and one of them was sailing. And he was actually in the process of building a new yacht. And he decided, I will put up half of the funds to build a harbor if I can put my yacht in the harbor. And so ultimately, the people of Santa Barbara voted overwhelmingly in favor of this. And he actually put up the funds for that. And that was just to build the initial breakwater portion that runs parallel to the shore. So when you look out, that's the part you see out in the ocean. And then we actually had that problem of longshore drift and sand coming back into play. And so they realized they needed an arm to connect the breakwater to the shore to block out the sand, because ultimately the sand was blowing into the harbor and then the breakwater was blocking the waves. So they couldn't move the sand in the harbor further down along the beach. So ultimately that was how it came about. And Max Fleischmann actually ended up putting several thousand more dollars towards the construction and towards those upgrades.
And so the Yacht Club, the Brophy's Restaurant, and the Maritime Museum all sit on about 30 feet of water that used to be part of the ocean.
So I have to ask this question. So I come from a long line of engineers. I'm the only person in the family that isn't an engineer. In those days, so 1929, was there a specialty engineer to build such a wharf? You know, somebody who was familiar with drift and vectors and all the, I mean, or was it just Mr. Fleischman who was, as you say, Lydia, a Renaissance man and took it upon himself? Who was responsible for the engineering?
Sure. So initially, in the early 20s, Leeds and Barnard were engineers from LA, and they actually proposed several sites for the harbor. And then I believe when they started building the harbor, that was who Max Fleischman went with. And then I think the contractor stopped for some reason or other. I'm not sure. And they found a new contractor and new engineers to finish it up. And I believe that was Merritt, Chapman's, and Scott.
And there would have been breakwaters like this in other ports, like would have already been. So I think those engineers had some background with this type of work.
And so this was opened in 1929 then. Was there a celebration?
So it was actually finished in June 30th of 1930. I'm sure there was a celebration, and actually those two white columns, as you're walking from the parking lot into the harbor along the breakwater, have plaques on them which commemorate Fleischman, the engineers, the contractors, and actually have a very faded picture of the Haida, which was Fleischman's ship that the harbor was ultimately built for.
What was the ship's name?
Haida, H-A-I-D-A. And they were an indigenous tribe up in Canada.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And one of his ships is still in the water. It might be visiting us here in a year or two. It's on the East Coast.
Tell me more, Greg. Tell me more.
Right. Well, Lydia might know more about it, but we were contacted by the captain of the boat, and he wanted more information about the boat. And so, Lydia, where is that boat now?
I believe it's in the Mediterranean. But they said they would be making a trip up to or around to San Diego next year.
So we're hoping to bring it to Santa Barbara.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Because, you know, his house still exists. You know, people take classes in his house from Pacifica. So Fleischman's house still exists.
And, of course, he started the Santa Barbara Foundation as well. So his generosity lives on for all of us through the breakwater, the harbor, and all the wonderful work that the Santa Barbara Foundation does.
And so, Lydia, you told me your favorite image is Cabrillo Street with the gauge railway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So when you're selecting these images, what's your criterion?
Well, it's kind of difficult. I wanted to kind of go throughout the decades and show, you know, kind of like a snapshot from each decade of how the landscape and the waterfront changed. And really show what life was like. You know, people used to get around by horse, and now we all have cars and buses and all of this transportation. So just to kind of show that evolution and kind of show some of those keystone moments, but also what daily life would have been like.
And can you tell me a little bit, just before we go to quick break here, can you tell me a little bit about what the harbor looked like previous wasn't a harbor, I guess. What was the waterfront like in the Chumash, because didn't the Chumash have some kind of encampment at the end? And then when they built one of the hotels, didn't they fill in something? I seem to remember that. Greg, you're shaking your head. Yes. Tell me more.
Well, I'll do a little bit. I'm sure Lydia knows this as well. So Burton's Mound, where Potter built the Potter Hotel in, 1903, was a Chumash burial ground. Of course, there's Hammond, what we call now Hammond's Meadow in Montecito, also had a Chumash living there. So, yeah, I mean, they were all up and down this waterfront, the whole Santa Barbara area, all the way up to Point Conception. So there were Chumash villages everywhere. The Goleta Slough was an important Chumash area as well. So certainly they were all along our coastline and out on the islands, of course.
Yeah, so out at the airport, what Greg mentioned, Mezcaliten Island was actually one of the largest villages in California at the time, estimated to have about 800 to 1,000 people. And then closer to the harbor was Siuctun, which means where the two trails run. And that was Chief Yeninale's village, which we have Yeninale Street to commemorate that. And there were actually freshwater springs in Pershing Park, directly adjacent to that village, in what's now Pershing Park today. And that was where many of the European explorers stopped and landed their skiffs and filled up their water barrels. But there were many villages, more up along the coast. There was one up on top where City College is now, Mispu, and Emalomel at the foot of Mission Creek. And now at what's now the Andre Clark Bird Refuge, also, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but Suatete was another village. So they were, there were lots of many small villages along the coast, and they were all heavily involved with the ocean. They built plank canoes. They used these canoes called tamoles, and they paddled as far south as Catalina Island and far up the coast, and they engaged in fishing and trade, and this was their main source of transportation.
Now, you said there was an island by the airport that was the biggest village. Is that island still around?
No, actually, they tore it down and filled it in to make the airport.
Really?
Yeah. Well, so, right, that's all marshland out there. Yeah. And so all of the solid land came from leveling that island.
And there was a boat built out there. That's why we call that Goleta, because that's a Spanish name for a boat. And some people believe that Cabrillo is actually buried on that island in that slough, and not out San Miguel or some of the other islands it's believed to be. It's very nebulous which island he was eventually buried on.
Well, how did he die?
Obviously after and during that voyage, they started to get scurvy because they didn't have any fresh fruit. And then he fell and I think had an injury to his leg. And so between that, the gangrene forming on his leg and the scurvy, I believe is what did hit him in. Right, Lydia?
Yes.
So Lydia's become our historical expert. She's just amazing. So we do cocktail parties in the summer for our members. It's free for our Navigator Circle members. And every one of those parties, Lydia brings an artifact or something related to an exhibit we're doing and does a wonderful 10-minute talk about that. She has really, her local maritime knowledge is just incredible now.
That's fantastic, Lydia. I have to say, there's a growing scholarly interest in the thing that you do and the thing that I do, because I do kind of an interpretation of objects my whole career. It's been 30 years of interpreting objects. It's called material culture. And it's anthropological, it's archaeological, it's psychological, it's all of the above, but it has to do with the fact that the object can speak without actually using text as a source. The object can be a source. And there's a whole school of, it kind of occurred in England first at Oxford, and it's kind of branched out into like a whole discipline now where it's material culture is the study of the material previous to the thought about the material. It's sort of like looking at the object, letting the object speak. Well, we have to go to a quick break. And I'm thinking that we're changing for the last 15 minutes. And we are actually going to talk, Greg, about the Santa Barbara Revels Harbor Sing, which is October the 15th from 5 to 7. It's a cruise around Santa Barbara Harbor aboard the Condor Express. They're going to be there singing in the sea air with the sunset. And there'll be favorite sea shanties and folk songs, traditional tunes, and a no-host bar, snacks, and a songbook. I know Richard's going to go. And so Richard talked me into having the folks that are organizing this on the air for the last 15 minutes. So I want to say thank you to Lydia Rayo and Greg Gorga, my friend at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, for talking to us about this fantastic show, 170 years of harbor history. Thank you, especially to Lydia, for putting this together for us. And I can't wait to see it. Thank you, guys. Hey, Richard, let's go to a quick break. When we get back from the break, let's introduce Bill Egan and Samantha DeRossi, the executive director of Revels, to talk a little bit about the harbor cruise. So it's all about the harbor today. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm talking about all things harbor today, Santa Barbara Harbor. And I just want to give a shout out to the Santa Barbara Rebels. Richard has talked this up with me, and he's a member of this. His friend, Bill Egan, is here. And we're talking about a couple of events that are happening. Now, first of all, what are the Rebels? The Rebels is it's a theater group, but they do all kinds of other they sing a lot, they dance, they bring foster a sense of community, and it's sort of multi-diverse people, cultures, etc. And it's about fulfilling the human need for celebration. Of course, it's on stage as a theatrical production, and usually around Christmas time at the Libera Theater. They are doing Tales from Ellis Island, December 16th and 17th at the Libero. But to kind of get the fundraising arm together and to get excitement going, there's two things happening. One is the Harbor Sing. This is so cool. Inexpensive, $40 online. It's the Harbor Sing with the Santa Barbara Rebels. It's a cruise around Santa Barbara Harbor the night of October 15th. Wine and snacks. Song leader Micah Vasili. How do you say that name, Sam?
Vasilici.
It's actually Mika. First name is pronounced Mika.
Okay. So is their song leader. And they're going to sing sea shanties, favorite folk song, traditional tunes. As you tour around, can you imagine the sound of the waves and clinking of glasses and the beautiful voices? There's many people that really know how to sing in the Rebels. And Richard Dugan will be there, etc. I want to introduce just very, very quickly Samantha DeRossi. And Sam has been working professionally in around theater for a decade. She works in Santa Barbara and Denver. She is, she joined the Rebels 7 years ago. And she went from stage manager, a thankless job, in my opinion, boy, stage management, to production stage manager, to executive director. She's worked for a lot of our theater companies, Drama Dogs, Dog Star, Producing Unit, Nebulas, Sela Dance Collective, etc. And she's directed a number of wonderful things, too, in town. She has a BA in theater and community from University of California, Santa Barbara. She is adjudicated the Colorado New Music Festival. And she sits on the board of Backstory Theater and founding member of Quark Theater. Sam is seasoned, and she writes in her bio that she's only an actor if something goes terribly, terribly, horribly wrong. She'd rather do other things in theater. And Bill is with us. I just saw Bill as the lead in 154 in Paradise, the play that, oh my gosh. Absolutely wonderful play. He's an actor, director, producer in 40 productions and a co-founder of the Producing Unit Theater Company. He's a 10-year Rebel veteran and vice president of the Rebels Board of Directors. So, Bill, tell me what the event's going to be like. Oh, and there's a fundraiser as well. I neglect to mention there's a fall online auction open now through October 16th, and it's lots of wonderful packages, dinners, getaway packages, special performances, personal services, etc. New items added daily. So, Bill, tell me about the cruise. I want to hear about that first.
So, yeah, the cruise is like you had mentioned. We'll have Mika, who'll be leading those, and you know, sea shanties and folk songs will perform Rebels favorites such as Danny Boy, Alito, The Water is Wide, Shenandoah, The Wild Rover, which is Irish. So, and it ties into some of the cultures that we'll be depicting and be on stage in December The Tales from Ellis Island will have the Jewish contingent, will have an Irish contingent, will have a Mexican contingent, will have a German contingent. And it's really a beautiful show. It's one of the best shows that I've been a part of in 10 years that, from a script standpoint, because it very seamlessly ties in. And with everything going on in the world right now, as we know, this is really going to be hopefully a very impactful show, but also a celebration of the season, as we always do, but really depicting, you know, the community and love.
Hey, Bill,
absolutely.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because it takes place in 1924, this is somehow also, there's a sort of an undercurrent where the law had changed and now there were quotas. And at that particular point where this performance, this play takes place, the quotas had been met on Christmas Eve. So that's why this is happening, that these people are all together.
Thank you. Yeah, nice inclusion. Appreciate that. But as so, far as the Condor Express, Elizabeth, it's going to be just a ton of fun. And, you know, the song leader, there'll be a cordless mic. So people want to get on the action and they pass that around and have some fun. Absolutely.
Booklets included with the music and the lyrics so everybody can jump in.
A little song book is included. Yeah. Okay. And Richard's saying that we have to go to quick break. Are we going to break right now, Richard?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. But quick break. When we get back, I just want to hear a little more detail. Sam, I want you to tell me more about the revels and what they are exactly. Okay. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Everybody. Well, welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. We're talking about Santa Barbara Revels, and I'm joined by Susan DeRossi, and Samantha DeRossi. And I want to know, Samantha, what are the Revels?
Well, part of the Revels struggle is that it's hard to kind of explain quickly, and we've been working on that this year. And we kind of recently came up with the phrase interactive concert experience. So if you've been to any of our small pub sings at Dargan's or anything, we have musicians and the song leader kind of leading the, you know, teaching and singing on their own and then bringing people in. And every event we do kind of scales up from there. So the Harbor Sing is going to be, you know, our song leader and our guitarist. We're featuring Joshua Jenkins on guitar. We'll be singing and we'll be leading everyone, but then anybody can step in and lead the song. Anybody can step in and sing. People can come up with new, you know, bring in a new song that's not in the booklet if they know it well enough to teach it. And then the winter show, our very big event at the Libero, is kind of that on a grander scale. So we've got our adult chorus and we've got our children's chorus, children and teen choruses, and then, you know, they're the ones singing, but then there's songs where the house lights come up and everybody joins in and there's words in the program. So the end of the first act always includes Lord of the Dance. So everybody comes through the audience and grabs hands and everybody is able to dance together out into the patio. So it's really, it's an interactive concert experience where you get to go and watch the show and see, you know, some storyline and some acting and a lot of singing, but you get to do it too. You get to participate. And then, you know, we always hope that people that enjoy participating in the audience will come audition next year and be part of it.
And just real quick, Sam, just to interject here. So Revels was started in Cambridge many years ago. There are now 10 Revels companies, Elizabeth, throughout the United States, and we are one of them.
Okay, so it started in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so do the Revels, do they get together? I mean, is there one like Revels meet?
Sam can speak. There's a conference every year where we talk about shows that we're doing. And then, you know, if someone has done a show, like there was another group that did the Revels show that we're doing this year.
Okay, big shout out, Harbor Sing. That's coming October 15th, 5 to 7 p.m. above on the Condor Express with the Santa Barbara Revels. Not to be missed, $40 online. Go get your tickets. It's going to be a great evening. You get to meet Richard and Bill and Sam. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you.